This is Winfield Bible School, 1998. Our overall theme this week is Next Year in Jerusalem. This is class number one with our brother Chris Sales, and his class title is Christianity and the Crusades. Brother Chris? I've been asked to pass this on, Brother Chris, before you start, some sporting equipment.
Good morning, brethren and sisters. First of all, a few words of, defense or something. Brother Peter's been saying a lot about preparation and whatnot by some of the other speakers. And I just wanted to make aware to you all, as far as I'm concerned, the ones that put in the most preparation and whatnot are the teachers of our children. I don't know if you've seen them, but with their maps and charts and crafts and puzzles and all kinds of things. As far as I'm concerned, that any Bible school, it's the ones that teach the kids that do the most work. So we'll just say that to start off with. What I'd also like to do before we get into today's topic, which if you'll notice in the notes, we've had to expand just a bit. We had Christianity and the Crusades. Initially, we've had to add on the Turks. They play a fairly significant role. And if you thought yesterday we went through a lot of material, today's going to be even a little bit more as we try to push our way all the way to this century. So we're going to go through about another 1,000 years very quickly. But to begin with, just a couple of things from yesterday. We talked about Muhammad, and I did have a map. I don't know how well you're going to be able to see this, especially if it's backwards. There we go. Just again, for a little bit of geography for you, here's Israel up here, okay, Mediterranean Sea. So here's the Red Sea here and the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea, just to kind of get your bearings. So here's Saudi Arabia in here. Mecca is right here. It's spelled Mecca, but it's the same place where Muhammad kind of developed. That's where he worked. Medina is right in here. So here's the first Muslim holy site, the second, and then, of course, Jerusalem, the third. So that's just sort of for your own information, just to kind of get your bearings a bit. So that's where Islam kind of originated. Now, I had another question. I'm going to use this map again in a minute. But on page, I forget what it is, I think it's page 4 or 5 of your book, there's this picture, which is modern Jerusalem. And I guess some were looking ahead, and we talked a little bit about this yesterday. But you can see that even today, Jerusalem's divided into quarters. You have a Christian quarter with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre here, Jewish quarter with the Western or Wailing Wall here, which again you can see from this picture is really just a part of the retaining wall for the Temple Mount. You've got the Muslim quarter here with the Dome of the Rock prominently featured, and the Armenian quarter. And Brother Jeff Smith was asking about the Armenians, so I tried to do a little bit of more work. The Armenians, Armenia is a place right here, okay, just between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, and they were Christian, and actually they broke away from the Western Church in about the 5th century, and interestingly enough, the issue was over Christ's nature, and the Armenians held the view that Christ only had one nature, that being a divine nature. And they became known as monophysites or something that means one nature. Whereas the Roman church sort of had this duality of nature, humanity and divinity. So these Armenians, some of them established themselves in Jerusalem and just kind of grew and bought land and whatnot such that they were sort of there permanently. So that's just a little bit of background to the four different quarters of Jerusalem. So that's the Armenians. Brother Jeff, good question. And just one other thing. This is inside the Dome of the Rock, this overhead, and the map were thanks to Brother Ron Eason. I get by with a little help from my friends, as the saying goes. And so here's inside the Dome of the Rock. This helps to see some of the shapes and whatnot and how it's decorated. And this is the rock, which we mentioned the Muslims believe Abraham offered Ishmael on. And Brother Winton also reminded me this is the rock that they say Muhammad received his vision from heaven as he was carried here by the angel Gabriel. So that's just a little picture of that. So a little bit of sort of background or recap of some of the things that we've done. It was also mentioned to me that we mentioned yesterday how Islam and Muhammad, his views initially were, he thought, close to Christian and Jewish beliefs. And the Quran, if you were to read it today, has quite a bit of it filled with hate towards the Jews. So that if a Muslim kills a Jew, he kind of gets a better place in heaven type of thing. And that's true. In fact, they teach their children little nursery rhymes about hatred towards Jews and killing Jews. Obviously, that's something that's developed since the time of Muhammad. I mean, that was not Muhammad's teaching. That's something that's grown. And I think after today, you'll see why it's grown and why the animosity between Christian, Jew, and the Muslims is there. So initially, it wasn't that way, but certainly it's indoctrinated in them today. Now, we finished yesterday with Jerusalem being a Muslim city, and that's the last one we looked at. So you can see that the time period there, 638 to 1099. And the Christians are being allowed to live. The Jews are allowed in, and the Muslims have control. And that's sort of where we left Jerusalem. And we'll pick the story up on page 13 of our notes. And if someone can maybe get me a glass of water, I would appreciate that. Another can, perhaps. Thanks. Now, as we say in point one there on page 13, Jerusalem was a fairly prosperous city. Thanks, Brother Harold. And because it was also, the Muslims had allowed this freedom of worship with others, it was a place that was visited by many people. People took pilgrimages here. Christians still came to visit the places, and they were allowed free access. Thanks, Brother Ken. And the Jews frequented the city. And as we say in point one there, it was a prosperous city. The walls were restored, and the buildings were restored. And thousands of people came year by year making pilgrimages from all over the world to this site. So that's kind of the situation that Jerusalem was in during this time period. Now, what happened back in Europe at this time, as we've noted there in point five, Emperor Alexius asked Pope Urban II for military help, and the Pope having big ideas. Now, when he asked for military help, it was for a bigger picture than just Jerusalem. They had this war or this strife going on between Christians and Muslims throughout the land, throughout the area there. The Pope got his eyes on Jerusalem. It was a pretty prominent place, and he wanted control of it for himself. And so he and the priests and whatnot started to preach the liberation of Jerusalem from evil. This idea that Muslims were bad was starting to be preached amongst the people and kind of whipped up into a bit of frenzy. You know, wouldn't it be great to have Jerusalem, the city of the great king? We can have it back. We had it under Constantine. We've lost it to these, filthy, Arabs and so on. Let's get it back. And so this was preached from the pulpits of Europe. And you can see the people in verse or point number six there kind of picked it up. The knights, the clergy, and the people thought it was a great idea. And apparently, throughout the land, God wills this. We've got to get Jerusalem back. And I don't know what your what you thought of the Crusades up until this point. Perhaps you were better read than I was, but I had no idea about what we're about to learn here this morning. I sort of the Crusades were almost sort of romanticized in certainly in Western culture and the media. And in fact, I can remember hearing songs about it in popular pop songs, and it was very it's like the white Christians, the right people, went and delivered it from evil. And this was kind of how it was portrayed. And, their victory was sort of a victory for God. And that's certainly what the people seem to have thought in their response to this appeal to go to Jerusalem and liberate it. So point number seven there, in the spring of that year, five armies of 60,000 soldiers set off from Europe to go to Jerusalem. And many other people sort of went along with them, pilgrims with their wives and families, and they set off. And it's important to sort of note that at this time then, 1099, actually before that, sorry, because they arrived in 1099, so about 1096, the Pope gave license for Christians to fight. They had his blessing. This was going to be a holy war from the Christian side. And again, these are Christians in inverted commas. Now, it was quite a long journey. Many died on the way. They weren't really well prepared. They sort of thought, it was just in their zeal, they just kind of set off for Jerusalem. And sort of slip down there to point number 11, the life of a crusader was quite difficult. There was scarce food. It was a long journey. In fact, from some of the places in Europe to get to the Middle East took 3 years. Now, later they would have come on boats, and the journey was to be a bit quicker, but if they sort of migrated cross-country throughout Europe down to Jerusalem, in some situations took up to 3 years, and many died along the way. Now, something else interesting happened along the way, and that is that these crusaders, you know, with their swords and their desire to fight for God, along the way persecuted Jews. I don't know what the connection was. I mean, they were going to Jerusalem to deliver it from these Muslim overlords. But along the way, again, with this this false idea that somehow they were, you know, seeking revenge for the death of the Son of God. In fact, for the Christians, they thought that they were avenging the death of not just the Son of God, but of God himself, because they had this confused idea of the Trinity. And in fact, they said the Jews were guilty of deicide, killing God. I mean, bizarre ideas. But while they went through, they persecuted Jews. In fact, they would wipe out entire villages. They would just be kind of wandering through on their way to Jerusalem and say, hey, let's wipe out this city of Jews, this town of Jews. And they did that. And so you can see the persecution, and especially originated from some of the crusaders in Germany. And that's going to have great significance, obviously, when we look at our class tomorrow on this past century. So these are the roots of this anti-Semitism. These what are called pogroms against the Jews, persecutions, genocide, we might call it today. So again, that's just sort of an interesting little aside. Now, point number 12 there, the Crusaders first took Antioch in 1098. So that was, Antioch is to the north of Jerusalem as they came around, and we're going to come now down towards Jerusalem. They first took Antioch in 1098. 1 in 7 men died of starvation, and half the army deserted. So these five armies of 60,000 soldiers were dwindling quickly. But finally, they took that city. They came to Jerusalem, and as they were coming towards Jerusalem, many of the Christians that were here in Jerusalem heard of what was going on, knew what was coming, and fled the city. They didn't want any association with the Christians. That they'd heard the stories of what was happening, of the slaughter. In some cases, cannibalism of these desperate, starving people. And they didn't want any part of it, and they got out. Any that remained in the city were eventually thrust out by the Muslim leaders, thinking that, you know, they would sort of turn on them as the Christians arrived. They finally came to Jerusalem and surrounded the city. When they surrounded the city, they really didn't have any idea on how they were going to take it. Again, these people sort of just left without much planning, without much thinking, and they arrived to Jerusalem and say, okay, what do we do next? How are we going to take the city? It's a city. It's got walls. What are we going to do? And you can see there in point number 15, they surrounded Jerusalem but were unsure how to attack a well-fortified city. They didn't have any plans. So what they did was some new crusaders were arriving by boat, and they had arrived at the coast of Israel. Their boats come to Jerusalem. Someone went back to get the boats, break them all up, bring the wood back, and build towers so they could take the city. And if you just turn over the page, page 14, you can see there's a picture there of crusaders taking Jerusalem in 1099. You can see some of the pictures of the towers that they built from the wood that they had gotten from the boats that some crusaders had arrived on. So again, they were kind of just making it up as they went along. Point number 17 on page 13, July 15th, 1099. That's the key date, July the 15th, 1099. They broke into the city and proceeded to slaughter all 30,000 inhabitants of the city over a three-day period. I guess they were perhaps desperate. Again, they hadn't really thought out exactly what they were going to do, and things were just happening as they went along. And so we have a picture there of Crusader Jerusalem. You can see up here, apparently this was the breach point up here in the north part of the city. They came in and slaughtered all 30,000 inhabitants. Each crusader was allowed to own any house and property he entered in first. And that was the one thing they had said. Okay, whatever you get to first, it's kind of like finders keepers. First one in, that's what you get. And so a mob scene as they went rampaging through the city, sort of staking their claim in whatever part they came to, slaughtering everyone in their sight. And again, this is from historians' writings. Point number 19. Blood ran everywhere. Piles of heads, hands, feet, and bodies lay all around. The horses were said to have been walking in blood up to their knees in the city. And again, I just tell you these things just because they were certainly a shock to me in my previous understanding of what the Crusades were all about. And we simply ask ourselves the question there. You know, this was Christian behavior. This was people acting as Christ would. Moving in and slaughtering everyone that came before them. All Muslims and Jews in the city were ruthlessly killed. Now, the Christians felt that their success, that is, that they were actually succeeding in what they were doing, justified what was going on. The ends kind of justified the means, as far as they were concerned. And God must be blessing them, because look at the success they were having in taking the city. That's what they felt. And after this course, after treating people in this way, both Muslims and Jews, Muslims particularly were, from that point on, considered, as it says here, this is a quote, a vile and abominable race, fit only for extermination. That was the Christian perspective from that point on. So no wonder now we see, as we see the hatred between these different groups today, this is the roots of it, and you can see what it's grown into even today. It took more than 5 months for the Crusaders to clean up the mess. Now they were in control. They had Jerusalem back. Jerusalem was now free from these Muslim overlords. The Crusaders had no idea of what to do next. They had no plan beyond taking the city and were not prepared for governing it. And at that point, many went home. Guess it's over. We did what we wanted to do. We don't know what to do next. Went home. A city that used to have up to 100,000 people in it now only had a few hundred. And the rest were all dead corpses, I guess, to get rid of. Now, it's interesting then. Let's just put that Muslim map back up. You can see that the Christians came in, wiped out the Jews, wiped out the Muslims. What about some of the Christians that were still in the area? Interestingly enough, any Christians that had been previously living in the city were likewise mistreated and banished. Point number 25 there on page 14. This leader that was sent by the Pope to kind of look after things immediately banished from the churches any Christians who had previously lived in Jerusalem. They were Greeks, Jacobites, Armenians, and they were banned from any of the churches. It was as if these Christians from Europe who had liberated the city felt that, you know, they'd be guilty of contamination by association. Someone who had lived with Muslims in the same city and with Jews were cast out and banished. They were excommunicated. And certainly no Jews or Muslims were allowed to enter into Jerusalem. Now you can see this is the area, the Temple Mount, to focus in on. That's kind of your focal point in each of these maps as we go through. It was turned into a church. Interestingly enough, we were talking to the teenagers yesterday. Now, it's amazing the Dome of the Rock is still there today. That might be an interesting question for perhaps tonight that we can banty about. You know, why is it still there? Why didn't the Christians come in and just destroy it here? why haven't the Jews, you know, and the opportunities they've had, all the wars that have taken place in that city since it was built in 688, you know, it's still there today. So they just kind of took it over, called it the Temple of the Lord, but they didn't change much to it in terms of the outside. Inside, they brought in all their paraphernalia, statues, pictures, and stuff, because remember, there was nothing in there but these geometric shapes of the Muslims. And it was filled with all the Christian paraphernalia. Just a couple of notes there at the bottom of page 14 before we move on. The first one there, from 1096 to 1270, there were 8 major crusades and 2 children's crusades, both in the year 1212, these 2 children's crusades. And they're exactly what they say they are. In Europe, all this sort of hype, the crusades were really hyped, and of course the information coming back was not clear, so it was all propaganda, you know, the success that we were having and so on. There were children who got caught up in this wave of zealousness, and bunches of them just set off, all children with no adult supervision, loaded onto ships themselves, 12, 13 years old, and set off for the Holy Land. And most of them died again on the way. And that was what was going on in the year 1212. It says there only the first and third crusades were successful. So out of the 8 plus the 2 children's crusades, 10 crusades, only the first and third were successful. The first was the one we just heard about in 1099, where they came in and slaughtered everyone. The third was only marginally successful, only could be classified as successful in the sense that the leader of the crusade was able to broker kind of a treaty which allowed Christians access to the city. So if you call that successful, you know, that's only in the sense that he didn't lose, but he didn't win, and he gained access to the city for pilgrims. And just one other point there that I wanted to draw your attention. Again, you can read the rest of it at your leisure. The 5th point there. On the breast of their tunics, the crusaders wore a cross of blood-red cloth. Those who returned from the crusade wore the cross on their backs. So they turned their tunics around so the cross was always facing Jerusalem. The Latin word for cross is crux, and from this comes the word or the name crusader. That's why they're called crusaders, this blood-red cross of cloth on their tunics. So I thought just a bit of interest there. Now, at the bottom, there's a little bit of information about this man named Saladin, who we're now going to talk about. So we'll leave that there. Just turn over the page. The next sort of significant player in Jerusalem is this Muslim leader named Saladin. So the Crusaders kind of had control of Jerusalem up to this point, 1187. And that's when this Muslim ruler Saladin seized Jerusalem. And he was the one that the Third Crusade came against and was able to broker, through Richard the Lionheart, was able to broker a bit of a treaty that allowed access to Jerusalem. But the Muslims never lost control of it. And the other 8 Crusades were not successful at all and never gained access. Now, you have to understand then that the Crusaders who had control of the city from 1099 to 1187, what their track record had been in terms of brutal and ruthless behavior towards the Muslims and the Jews. So on page 15, point number 1, on October 2nd, 1187, Saladin and his troops entered Jerusalem as conquerors. Point number 2, not a single Christian was killed. They surrendered. There was not a battle. They surrendered to Saladin and his army, and not one was killed in the process. And as you look at now Jerusalem, as it becomes, as the title says, the Islamization, making Islam the city of Jerusalem, this was the sort of group that Saladin belonged to. Ayyubids, I guess you say. Just look at the city. The Dome of the Rock is now the Dome of the Rock again, but the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is still here. There's still parts of it that you know that are Christian. If you just compare the two maps, they didn't sort of obliterate Christianity. They just moved in as leaders. So not a single Christian was killed. Point number three, the poor Christians who could not redeem themselves and were to be sold as slaves. So that's one thing. I mean, they moved in. Those that could buy their freedom were allowed to pay the Muslims and leave if that was what they desired to do. But some of the poor Christians in the city weren't able to do that. So the Muslims said, well, we're not going to kill you. We'll sell you as slaves, so at least you'll have your life. And this was the plan. But notice, large numbers were released because Saladin, the leader, was moved to tears by the plight of families being separated. And so he was moved to compassion as he saw these Christian families being broken up by their Muslim overlords and to be sold as slaves. And he said, no, you can go free. In fact, Saladin's brother was so distressed that he personally bought 1,000 prisoners for his own use and released them on the spot. So the Muslims had moved in, and some of the Muslim conquerors had taken the Christians captive. They were instructed not to kill them, but they were going to sell them as slaves. And in this situation, both Saladin and his brother came to their aid and allowed them to go free. Now, just to kind of tighten the screws a little bit more, point number five there, all the Muslims were scandalized to see rich Christians escaping with their wealth without making any attempt to ransom their brothers. In fact, there's one story in which one of the Christian leaders was leaving Jerusalem with a chariot so weighed down with gold and silver and treasures that the horses could hardly pull it as he left the city. And some of the princes of the Muslims said to Saladin, you're going to just let him go? I mean, meanwhile, there's all these Christians here who could be ransomed and released, and you're doing your own, you're going to let this guy get away with all this stuff? And Saladin let him go. In fact, he said there as point six, Christians everywhere will remember the kindness we have done unto them, is what Saladin is said to have said at that time. And in fact, he was right. Point number seven, Christians in the West were uneasily aware that this Muslim ruler had behaved in a far more quote-unquote Christian manner than their own crusaders. And I'm just sharing this with you because it was certainly a shock to me. I had no idea in my own previous limited knowledge of history had any idea that this was what happened. Now, certainly things have changed, brothers and sisters. I'm not trying to say, you know, Muslims are great people or you know, Islam's a great thing. Things have changed. You see, today, the hatred is on both sides. It's just important for us to understand the background to this. It gives us a different perspective, perhaps, when dealing with these people, if you happen to meet them. Or when you read the current events, you read your newspapers, it just helps to see both sides of the picture. This is the roots of the relationship between these various groups. Point number eight. In terms of some of the mosques, the Muslims went in, took out the Christian artifacts, the Alaska Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. They took out the pictures and the statues. But point 10 is vital. Point 10 and 11 are kind of significant at this point. There was a new hostility towards the Christians from the Muslims due to the horror of the Crusades. This was a watershed, you might say, in terms of the relationship. From here on in, it was never the same. Although Saladin tried to have still integration within the city, and he tried to allow freedom of access to all parts, there was always an uneasiness, and it never really healed. And point number 11, instead of being a predominantly Christian city with an important Muslim shrine, i.e. the Dome of the Rock, Jerusalem was now an obviously Islamic city. And so for these number of years here, 1187 to 1250, and you'll see beyond for the next probably 500 or 600 years, Jerusalem is primarily an Islamic city. And, you know, it's got traces of Jewishness. It's got traces of Christianity, but primarily it's Islamic. In fact, the Arabs have their own name for Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And I think there's an index that gives you all the names of Jerusalem, or an appendix at the back. And that's one of them. And so again, Jerusalem, kind of in terms of the way we look at it, disappeared for a number of years. Point number 12, Saladin did not exclude Christians and Jews entirely. The old idea or ideal of integration and coexistence persisted. But when Saladin died in 1194, he must have been an amazing person. His uniting influence, that what he wanted to do, kind of died with him. And as family members quarreled for control, as so often happens, isn't that history repeating itself? Now Alexander the Great dies and his generals kind of break up the empire amongst themselves. Saladin passes away and there's infighting and quarreling as people try to take over. And many of them, in their zeal for Islam, persecuted Christians and Jews, and some of that did take place. There's some interesting little anecdotes there that we won't have time for at this time. But to finish with point number 18 at this stage, Islam and Christian West were finding it impossible to accommodate each other. On neither side was there any desire for coexistence and peace. Even though some of the leaders tried, and there's a little story there of Frederick II and this Al Kamil, who brokered a treaty amongst themselves to allow kind of freedom of access to the city. And both of them caught it from their own sides. The Christians were offended that Frederick would broker a treaty with this Muslim, and vice versa. And so it just seemed that coexistence was going to be a difficult thing. Now we'll move quickly through the next section. There's this sort of interesting little blip of almost 300 years, the Mamluks. And you can read it for yourself there. It's kind of interesting. These people, as it says there in point 2 on page number 16, they were tribesmen from Central Asia who had been taken as slaves into Egypt. And so this group of Mamluks were really a nation of slaves. The whole group of them were there in Egypt as slaves. At the age of 18, they became sort of professional soldiers, mercenaries perhaps. And this was how Egypt dealt with them. Well, in 1250, these soldiers who had been slaves in Egypt actually overthrew the Egyptian government and became the rulers of that part of the world and inherited all its provinces, including the area of Palestine and the city of Jerusalem. And so for almost 300 years, the Mamluks ruled there, 1250 to 1517. And you can see that, they were Muslims as well, but they were, as it says there, they ruled like military dictators. And point number 4, they were violent and lawless, but they had one interesting kind of little quirk. Because they had a heritage of being slaves, they made a law amongst themselves that said, you're not allowed to kind of accumulate wealth and pass it on to the next generation. We're slaves. It's our heritage. And so while they had all this prosperity and success, they just sort of funneled it into the here and now. And so many of Jerusalem's best architecture and sort of glory and grandeur comes from this period. Some of its most beautiful and unique buildings are from the Mamluks, which is just kind of interesting. But you can see in the city, there's a Christian quarter, there's an Armenian quarter. Jews were allowed in, although there was some tension between Jews and Muslims. The Muslim presence is still prominent, and there we have Jerusalem. Now, on the bottom of page 16, just very briefly, and as I mentioned to you before, when you're doing a study of Israel, if you're looking at the people, they move all over the place. Just to set ourselves up for really tomorrow's class and the 20th century happenings, you got to understand a little bit of what's going on with the Jews in Europe. And you can read those for yourself, those 4 points there at the bottom of page 16. The point that you got to understand is as the Bible had prophesied, the Jews found no resting place for their foot. Wherever they went, they were a byword and a proverb. There was no, at night they said, would God it were morning. And in the morning they said, would God it were night. And they were persecuted. They had some success, yes. They were good businessmen, yes. And that only increased the tension and the strife between the Jews and whatever people they were associating with. They never assimilated. They never integrated. And there were where many, many rumors started, and a couple of them are mentioned there. The main one is this, what's called blood libel. And it was a rumor that was spread like wildfire across Europe that said if a child went missing, or if there was some children that had died or were gone, it must have been the Jews who took it, because in their kind of weird religion that they had, they needed blood of humans and in part of their rituals. They were really people from the devil. This was the Christian perspective of Jews. And so sometimes a village would sort of rise up in anger against a Jewish community and go and just completely annihilate it. They were blamed for things like the Black Death. Even though so many Jews were dying as Gentiles, the Jews were blamed for it. It was somehow their presence that was the problem. Now we move on from the Mamluks. The Ottoman Turks took over. And this was a very, very significant time period. Look at that, 400 years the Ottomans ruled Jerusalem. And the Ottoman Empire, we think of today in terms of Turkey, the Turks. But they were very, very influential in this part of the world. But you'll notice again, there's an Armenian quarter. There's a Christian quarter. So things are still there. Church of the Holy Sepulchre is still there, along with a bunch of others. Point number one on page 17. The Ottoman Turks took over from the Mamluks, and people in Jerusalem were happy for this because the Ottomans brought back law and order. Where the Mamluks tended to be a lawless and a violent people, that was their heritage, slaves, live for the day, you know, survival of the fittest. The Ottomans were a much more sort of organized and a people, a much more, maybe say, so we say, civilized. And again, I just want to draw a few highlights here from page 17. Point number two, this man named Suleiman the Magnificent was the Turkish sultan from 1520 to 1566, is perhaps the most famous, improving the living conditions and rebuilding much of Jerusalem, including the walls, which were rebuilt after 300 years of neglect. 2 miles long, 40 feet high, with 7 gates. These are still the walls of the old city today. So he really sort of patched up Jerusalem. Now, in some cases, it was a bit of patchwork. And with the kids in CYC, we did watch a video on the gates of Zion, and it showed places where, in the rebuilding, the Turks, sort of in their haste and you know, wanting to get the job done, had rebuilt the walls, and some of the bricks are upside down or backwards. You can see that things didn't quite fit, you know, exactly well. But their goal certainly was to improve the city and its structure. And this Suleiman was the key figure in this time period. It's kind of ironic, I guess, in some ways, that the Jews saw him as their, you know, as some sort of a savior, or in that sense, that he came back and he was looking after their city. His name is the same in a rough translation of Solomon, which is kind of interesting. And as we say, many of the walls that you go and see today are from this time period. Point number three there. Wars between Europe, which was Christian, and the Turks, who were Muslim, led to a hatred of Islam throughout Europe. So again, this underlying seat of hatred is there between Jews and Christians, between Jews and Muslims. In fact, of the group of three, it was the Muslims and the Jews who were getting along the best, although there was even problems sometimes there. This is interesting. Point number four. Jews who were displaced from other countries like Spain, because of the Christian persecution, were encouraged by Suleiman to resettle in Jerusalem. You know, he had heard of, you know, there was like refugees, Jewish refugees, and he encouraged them to come and settle in the land. Just a bit of statistics there. In 1553, there were about 1,650 Jews in the city of 13,000 people. And this population grew and grew and grew. Point number five, Jews and Muslims lived in peace together in contrast to persecution Jews suffered in so-called Christian countries. It was at this time that Sulian made the Wailing Wall, or Western Wall, an official Jewish holy site. So this area here, which was later to become the Jewish Quarter more formally, was where the Jews were settling, and he allowed them to have a holy site here at the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall. And as we've already mentioned, point number 8, that the Jews considered Suleiman a friend of Israel, as they had Saladin, which is interesting, because as a Christian, or from a Christian country ourselves, I know myself learning history, Saladin was also always in my mind associated with evil and bad. But not so for the Jews. They were better off under Saladin than they were under the Christian crusaders. It was at this time, as the Jews established themselves in this area, that the Western Wall or Wailing Wall took on significance, and that's when they started the praying rituals, and you see them tuck the little notes in the cracks. It was the Jews of this time period of Suleiman in the early to mid-16th century that this started. Now, point 9, some tensions did arise between Muslims and Jews, especially where mosques and synagogues were close to each other. At times, the Ottomans closed Jewish synagogues. So the tensions were there. And, of course, it's grown and developed since then to today. There's hatred going all three directions. And again, as so often happens, point number 10, after Suleiman's death, things quickly deteriorated, and many Jews, Christians, and Muslims fled the city in fear of frequent raids on the city by Bedouin tribes. And so order tended to break down a little bit after Suleiman, and certainly the somewhat peaceful coexistence ceased to some extent. Now, we've mentioned that the Christian quarter, its main sort of area was this Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and we just want to focus on that for a few minutes before we close. This Church of the Holy Sepulchre, so kind of keep your eye on that. It's in the Christian quarter. It's sort of the main Christian holy site. Now remember, at this time, you've got different sort of factions of Christianity. We've already mentioned the Armenians. You've got European Christians who are still there from the Crusaders, particularly those from France. You've got Greek Christians. The Christian empire is dividing into an east and a west at this time. And you've got all representations from all of them here in Jerusalem. So what to do with a place like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? Well, point number 12, the Greek Christians and the Franciscan Christians, that is, Crusaders from France, began fighting for control of this church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, often physically fighting in their, quote, holy churches. This unchristian behavior was apparent to many people. And that was kind of interesting, but the Christian infighting was quite apparent to the Jews in the city, to the Muslims in the city. And again, what should the Christian goal be? Shouldn't it be to encourage Gentiles to come and accept Christ? And here their very behavior was repelling people from it, and certainly was not very impressive to Jews or Muslims. This went on. Look at point number 16 there. In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Franciscans, Greeks, Copts, and Armenian Christians had partitioned the church into four parts. This is how we'll solve the problem. We'll just divide the church in four, and we can each have a part, right? It's apartheid inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And so they shared the church. They couldn't figure out how to get along, so they just shared it, divided it up into four. Even though some of these men, had apartments elsewhere in the city, they dared not leave the church for fear that one of the other groups would take over their section. And so they lived there sort of around the clock, because they were afraid to leave, because if I left my quarter, one of the others might come in and take it. And so food had to be passed through them in the hole in the door. And you can go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre today, and you can see the little hole that they passed the food, or used to pass the food through. It often took them, point 17, several years to decide how to repair their church because of the great suspicion and mistrust between the various Christian groups. In fact, there was one situation where there was an earthquake, tremors, and there was some fairly serious damage to the structure of this church. And it took them 35 years to decide who was going to repair it, how it was going to be done, who was going to pay for it. and to try and work out how to fix their holy site. That's how strong the strife was between them. And this went on. Actually, if you just flip over we'll dip a little bit into tomorrow's section, page 19, and that'll save us some time for tomorrow. In meanwhile in Jerusalem. Point number one, the early 1800s was a time of internal problems in the city. Different Jewish groups were squabbling, Christians were still divided and bickering, and some conflict arose between Muslims, Christians, and Jews. So things are starting to deteriorate. In 1808, a fire in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre gutted the building. The Christians fought amongst each other as to who should rebuild it, the Greeks even taking the opportunity to erase traces of Franciscan influence in the church structure. So in other words, the fire had gutted some parts, so while no one was looking, they kind of took out some artifacts, the Greeks did, of the French sort of influence. And they took an opportunity to kind of obliterate that. And just to point number three there, finally, a Muslim family were given the key to the church because the different Christian groups could not trust each other with the responsibility to lock and unlock the building. And in this video we watched, you could see them. And in the morning, this guy, who's obviously not Jewish, he's Turkish, comes along, he gets this ladder down, he puts it up to the door, and he climbs up and unlocks it and gets in, unlocks the door and then puts the ladder away. Then at night, reverses the process and locks up the church. And the Christians couldn't sort of work that amongst themselves, so they gave it to a Gentile, to a Turk, to sort of look after things. Point number four. Here is a quote from a visitor to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The cops, say, are standing long before they have finished their service of 60 minutes. The Armenians have gathered in numbers around the choir, which was an area in the church, not to join in prayers, but to hum profane airs, to hiss, jabber, jeer, and snarl at the Coptic morning prayer. How'd you like that in your memorial meeting on a Sunday morning? There's another group kind of gathering outside, making a racket so it kind of disrupts your service. Well, this is how the Christians were treating each other. In fact, point number five, quite often fights broke out between the Christians and the Turkish guards had to intervene. Back to page 17, the last point there. Things were so awful in the city at this time, the late 18th century, that a traveler that reached Jerusalem in 1784 wrote, quote, we behold its walls leveled, its ditches filled up, all its buildings embarrassed with ruins. We scarcely can believe that we view that celebrated metropolis which formerly withstood the efforts of the most powerful empires. With difficulty, we recognize Jerusalem. And so with a magnificent beginning under Suleiman in 1517, it's rebuilt, the city repaired, upgraded, and so on. By the end of this time period, things have degenerated. And not because of invasion, not because a great power has come through and destroyed the city, but because of infighting, because of deep-seated hatred amongst the groups and within the groups, and just because of sort of lack of care, the city degenerates. And that's really where we're going to leave Jerusalem at this point as we pick it up tomorrow in the 20th century. Now, just before we close, I'd like to take the last couple of minutes again to maybe sort of draw out some exhortation for us. Again, I hope the history part of it you're finding somewhat interesting. And hopefully you've learned a few things that maybe you didn't know before. And it'll help in your, as always, knowing history helps then in your perspective of what's currently going on and certainly the future. But we always like to draw at least a couple of lessons from each section. And so point number one, I say there, what does your religion look like to others? And I don't know if it's an Uncle Bob Lloydism or someone like that, but you are the only Bible some people may see. And I'll quote that if that's all right, Uncle Bob. And I just want you to think about that in light of what we've learned today. And we'll focus on the Christians because, you know, we do associate ourselves with Christianity to some extent. And just think of their behavior both towards the Jews and the Muslims.
mean, if our main goal is to be a light unto the world, to help in the calling out of a people for Christ's name, how could this go on? How could this this outward slaughter of innocents and this inward bickering? I mean, how could that possibly be beneficial to a spreading of the gospel message? And if you remember back in, I forget if it was yesterday or the day before, under Constantine, when the Christians came to power, they lost their perspective. They had control. They were in power. And they lost really their perspective. And from then on, it became a struggle, an earthly struggle, a struggle with swords and fighting and so on. And so they lost their perspective of converting people in a real... It was now convert or die. Become a Christian or we'll stab you through. They'd lost that perspective. And you can see how that's now carried on. They lost Jerusalem to the Muslims. And so, you know, they were going to get it back. And they got it back through slaughter. Just horrendous slaughter of Jews and Muslims. And then when they were allowed in the city by their now conquerors, they bickered amongst each other. Who was going to have control of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? That became their focus. Who was going to be the group amongst the Christians to sort of take over? And so we have Matthew 5, verse 16 there. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. For what purpose? So they can say you're a really great guy? No. They may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. What kind of things would the Jews and Muslims be saying about the Christian God in heaven after witnessing their behavior? Would they be glorifying their Father which was in heaven? I think not. And you may know people today that even now say, look, you know, look at what Christians are like and all the different denominations and sects and whatnot. If they can't get it sorted out, why should I bother trying? And they walk away. They're you know, disenchanted with religion altogether. And, you know, we can say that about Christianity as a whole, and we try and stay apart from that, but we have to be careful even amongst ourselves, whether it be in our own local area or as a Christ body of Christadelphians throughout the world. I think it's important for us to see the kind of impact our behavior can have on others. So there's an exhortation for us personally as individuals and collectively as the body of Christ. And the second point there, and this just sort of hit home to me very strongly when I realized what the Crusaders were all about, because as I say, I kind of had a fictional view of it. And I ask you just to go to the reading. You're probably wondering what on earth the reading had to do with anything I've been saying. Hopefully you'll see now. If we go to Numbers, chapter 25, because I always had this sort of romantic view of the Crusaders, and you know, that they were delivering Jerusalem from the vile enemy. And, you know, you can see them marching there and sort of proud and you know, they'd won the victory kind of thing. But then you realize what they did and how they did it, you know, and just the slaughter and the mayhem that took place. And I couldn't help but think of this point, too, here. It's good to be zealous for a cause. Just be careful not to, quote, slaughter those who are you perceive to be in your way. And a couple of quotes there before we go to and close from Numbers. In Galatians 1, verse 13, this was Paul's feeling, how, yes, he was zealous. He was exceedingly zealous for the tradition of his fathers. But what it meant was he was persecuting others. He was hailing men and women and taking them off to jail. There's implications that there was torture involved and maybe even killing on Paul's part. In his zealous, it was a misguided zealousness. And thank God that Jesus came and stopped him in his tracks on the way to Damascus. Otherwise, you know, who knows what would have happened. And Paul certainly appreciated that. And then Titus 2, just the other side of the coin. We have to be zealous of good works. So yes, it's good to be energetic, it's good to be zealous, but just make sure that's tempered, that you're not sort of running over top of other people. And when I thought about that, it was drawn to my attention again, actually, at the Manitoulin Island Bible School by Brother Colin Badger. This incident here in Numbers, perhaps somewhere you'd go when you think of zealousness, and perhaps somewhere you'd go where you'd maybe even use the excuse to look, yeah, there may be people kind of fall by the way because of my zealousness for God. And I'm referring to this incident here where an Israelite brought in a Midianitish woman in this incident of Peor, where the Midianites sort of seduced the Israelites and therefore brought a curse upon them. And Phinehas comes along and kills the Jewish man, the Israelitish man, and the Midianitish woman right there in the spot and is commended for it. And you just can't help but read verse 11 and get what we're talking about here in terms of zealousness. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, hath turned my wrath away from the children of Israel while he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consumed not the children of Israel in my jealousy, or same word, zealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel. Now, does this seem contradictory from what I've just been saying? Here I've been saying, you know, be careful in your zealousness not to slaughter those in your way. And you might say, here, look what Phinehas did, and look how he was commended for it in his zealousy, in his zeal for his God. And I think the answer, brethren and sisters, is that really the principle of Phinehas is not in how many were killed, but in how many lives were saved. And I think that's what will perhaps temper our interactions with one another, inter-ecclesially, interpersonally. That, again, I'll just repeat that. The principle of Phinehas is not in how many were killed, but in how many lives were saved. Thank you.
...121 years, I calculated. I'm not sure if we'll get the same tomorrow. Just two short announcements. The pitchers have arrived.